Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and the cultures of consciousness await our further exploration. When I was a kid growing up, me and my friends were kind of odd, although I guess not so odd for Southern California in the late 70s and early 80s. We were interested in mysticism and psychedelics and pot and the Grateful Dead and some punk rock too, and we studied our hippie lore and about the 60s, and Carlos Castaneda played a very interesting role in our lives, because in some sense we were like going through that period that in traditional societies would be a rite of passage, you know, when you turn in from a boy to an adolescent and looking towards manhood. And you know, often in traditional societies, you go through some kind of weird rite of passage with all sorts of, you know, intense experiences, and they take you out and do something scary, or maybe there's some ordeal involved. And, you know, in some ways, our crazy, rather psychedelic lives sort of served that role, except, of course, we didn't have any elders. It was just us and whatever information we could glean from the sort of wreckage of the 60s. Counterculture. So for us, a lot of what we gleaned came through books. So we read Be Here Now, and we read Zen Flesh and Zen Bones, and we read Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and you know, we were into the material, the things we could find, the used books we could find for a dollar, and like the sold by hippies after they'd had enough of them. And Castaneda was a pretty important figure in our lives in terms of being kind of a guide, because in many ways the books are written, the earlier books especially, are written as guides. And, in the form of a fiction, in the form of a nonfiction anthropological discussion. And the funny thing, though, is that when I think back on it now, I can't really remember whether I or my friends thought of them as fictions or nonfictions at the time, which is kind of wonderful because, of course, while they're most likely fictions entirely, although there's, you know, interesting things woven into them, like all fiction writers do, the whole question of fiction and nonfiction when it comes to spiritual exploits and the imaginal plane, and it's a very complex one, and probably be talking about it later in this program. But in my mind, it wasn't really clear because it didn't really matter. And whether or not they were fairy tales, fables, it was the same kind of mesh as the other sorts of material that we were reading and that we were looking to for some kind of map for the worlds that we were exploring in our wayward, high school, goofy fashion. So it was very interesting many years later, in the 1990s, when I became aware that there was all sort of, kind of spiritual, not a movement, but really kind of an esoteric school that had grown up around Castaneda, and that was sort of offering in a fairly select way various courses. And I knew people who were kind of interested in the edges of it, and I knew someone who was friends with Bruce Wagner, who was a guy who was sort of involved with it on the edge of this kind of Hollywood scene. And it always had kind of a weird vibe to me, but I didn't really know very much about it. And it wasn't until much later that I found out that it was a very weird scene. In some ways, it seemed to make sense in relationship with the books, and in other ways, it seemed to be almost like a different person with a different kind of social experiment with different results that in some ways was unfortunately a rather typical kind of quote-unquote cult sort of story, at least in terms of what I could understand by watching a documentary and reading some stuff online, not really exploring it deeply. But so we're very lucky today on Expanding Mind to be talking with Amy Wallace, who was part of Castaneda's circle and also lovers with him during the 1990s, and wrote about her experience in Sorcerer's Apprentice. So I'm very interested in this because I've always been particularly interested in Castaneda. Obviously, one of the most intriguing and influential and sort of lasting figures of that period in terms of spiritual books, in terms of esoteric literature for the masses, so to speak. So, Amy, thanks so much for being with me on Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric. That was quite an introduction.
Yeah,
I liked it. That was very good. Well spoken, indeed.
This is great stuff.
We just didn't have any elders.
what did you say?
I liked when you said, well, we didn't have any elders.
Yeah.
Well, it's true.
It's true. We're kind of like finding our own way through these things, and that's kind of that's what's sort of wonderful and interesting and tricky about things like Castaneda's books, is because they fill a vacuum, and they can do it in a very marvelous way, but in some ways it's a different kind of situation than we can imagine is in a
There's something I'd like to speak to right away that you brought up. It's just like one of the most critical points of all you brought up in your introduction. Does it matter if it's fiction or not? And I used to say to myself when I read Castaneda before I'd met him, I met him when I was 15, I didn't get involved with him romantically, if you will, until I was, and cult-wise, until I was in my 30s. But I knew him a little bit during all the years in between. And I believed the books were real, but I would always take the position with people, but it doesn't matter, after all, does it? You know, it's all still there. But it was really, over the years I've come to believe that it sounds cool to say that it doesn't matter, but it does matter, because there are people that have committed suicide because Carlos died, and people who've read my book and didn't commit suicide because they said my book saved them, and so, you know, lives were on the line. And Carlos says, as anyone who's read Castaneda out there will remember, big thing about cutting off your family and friends, because it's important to cut all ties in this group, which is very cult classic thinking, and he had his very persuasive reasons for it. And I was like just about the only person that didn't have that dictum, and that we can talk about that, but everyone around me did. And so there were weeping and wailing mothers and children and traveling from all over the world to try to find their kids who'd come to Los Angeles from Argentina and wouldn't speak to them anymore, and heartbroken siblings. And there was people, when Carlos died, five people disappeared in a suicide pact. And there's some of their siblings are still, you know, wishing, hoping they're alive and trying to find them. And I want to
emphasize, I think that there's from my perspective, where I sit, there's still an enormous difference between the way in which books can function in the world of books, meaning the worlds in which we read and we get inspired, it opens our imaginations, these imaginations come in and shape our lives as readers. And that situation is in some ways a very different situation than an actual sociological situation that's basically a cult, where the same ideas that can be liberatory in a book that I'm reading as a kid in Southern California, where in some ways I think it doesn't matter, in the sense that the world that I'm being initiated into is a world where I have to recognize that I have to take responsibility for my own imagination, even though I'm not really sure what's going on, and it's a tricky world. And then when those ideas are implanted or used in a control mechanism in the kind of situations you're talking about, I mean, it's incredibly unfortunate, the stories. I mean, it was really kind of remarkable to me when I first discovered the story, and we can go into detail or not, depending. I mean, but if you go and, you know, watch the documentary and hear the story and read your book, you're like, wow, this is a really classic bad news scene.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, in a way, to just say, well, therefore, like, you can see the way that all this stuff is in the fiction and there's problems in the fiction, that it leads to that, even that's sort of complicated. So it's,
well,
it's
the fiction,
such a,
I mean, some of the books are so beautiful. I mean, the early books are really lovely pieces of literature. Whether he really wrote them or not, I don't know, but they are gorgeous, you know, just from the perspective of writing. And if you take the best of them, then you've certainly taken a lot of good things. On the other hand, if you're not you're a bright guy, you talked about taking responsibility for your thoughts, etc. Well, if you instead read the books and say, well, I think I'll just take really a lot of peyote and wander around in the desert, you could find yourself, you know, kind of dead or worse. Just, you know, by following a book. I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate with you a little here, but I know people who've treated the books as with such solemnity that they've formed their own pseudo-castaneda cults and with their own leaders. I actually knew a whole group of people that did that in Italy, and then they all moved here, and Carlos took the women as lovers and kicked the men out. It was quite a situation.
Let's go back, because we're talking about the way that these books or encountering the books can affect people. What about you? Like, when you first read the books, and like, what situation? What kind of life were you living? Leaving? What were you looking for? What were you seeking? What did they speak to you?
I'm going to have my birthday in a few days, and I'll be 56. So I was like just a little too young to be a 60s kid. I was like a late 60s, early 70s kid. And my brother was 8 years older and tremendous influence on me, and was a real 60s classic hippie, very political. My family was very political, very liberal. My father was a very, very famous author named Irving Wallace and wrote books that were considered very radical at the time, and to some extent still are. He wrote a book about a black man becoming president and was threatened with assassination, and I was almost kidnapped. So, you know, this is pretty rad stuff for the 60s. So I was very much of a classic. I read all those books you were talking about. I saw Ram Dass speak when his, you know, Be Here Now, you know, came out. I blah blah blah, and I was read Alan Watts and Timothy Leary, and I loved Carlos's books. The first one was kind of boring, but the second, the two after that, were really good. I mean, it's in my book, Sorcerer's Apprentice. I, you know, go into this because something really happened, and the book suddenly got very boring. And it's his books, and it's why he used to joke about it. So I wrote good books, and now I write boring books. Ha ha ha! But I got, when I was writing Sorcerer's Apprentice, I got an anonymous letter, or it was an email, I don't remember, saying, I work at Simon & Schuster, which published Carlos's books, and I don't want to lose my job, so I can't tell you who I am, but let's just say those books were not exactly written by Carlos, at least certainly not in their entirety, and that was pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. I mean, just even given the different voice that they have, you know, it's obvious that they're, you know, they're woven together, and then other scholars have gone in and kind of shown where different ideas come from. Like this section, it's almost a paraphrase from, you know, Tibetan Book of the Dead, and this part is, you know, from these Indians that are actually in South America, not in Central America. So people can do like an archaeology of and have done like archaeologies of these things to find all of their elements. They're definitely weird concoctions that come up. But did they speak to you more than some of the other stuff that you were reading at the time?
Yes,
or
they
what
did.
Was it that kind of
maybe
drew you further in?
I'm a writer, and I write fiction too, and I responded to the poetry in the books that I thought were the beautiful ones, and I responded to the stories, fiction or not. They were compelling in ways that some of the other books were dry. And the best of Carlos' works were far from dry. They were really moving, and they made you feel like you could find a teacher. You know, we talked about not having elders. They made you feel like you too could find a teacher. And then, I wanted to find a teacher. Okay, and being with Carlos was the second experience I had of having a. I used to be part of the Berkeley Psychic Institute in its earliest days. I don't know if it still exists anymore. But wrote a book about how to, you know, do psychic things without a teacher, but yourself, because it was always my feeling that teachers, how ironic, you know, that I would feel this way, were corrupting, and I left the Berkeley Psychic Institute because of the corruption that I saw there. And then I wound up with, in the incredibly corrupt situation. But there's something Carlos said. Nobody seems to remember this moment but me. But I was at one of Carlos's big organized workshops, maybe because I was standing right next to him as he was jumping off the stage. And he said, as he was stepping off the stage, 99% of everything I say is bullshit. So if you hear that at the end of these lectures where he says, if you don't follow this, you're doomed, you're left, well, was that the 1%? Which is the 1%? Uh-oh. You know, so he was known as the trickster, the coyote magic, that kind of thing, because he believed in lying as a form of spiritual work. And he encouraged us to do so. At the same time,
do you have a sense of like what I mean? Just
am I, I'm
in
sorry,
terms
am
of
I
his
answering
history.
Your questions or am I avoiding them?
when did he come out and start to do, you know, like sort of public talks and start to draw people into the whole sort of what became this very cult-like situation? I mean, did that happen in the 80s?
That's a really interesting question because nobody's ever asked me that before. And he was doing this way back in the very, very, very beginning when he just started to publish. He would speak at high schools. I met people would come up to me when I gave readings for Church Apprentice or would do signings and say, I saw Carlos speak at my junior college or at people's homes, like society. It was a society thing to have Carlos at your home. And in San Francisco, for example, I knew someone who used to host him. And he would speak and they would pack the house. So he was doing this to small groups for decades. And at some point, I guess in the 90s is when, like as you referred to, it got really organized. He started to charge. He never charged before that. He charged a lot of money after that.
That's a big difference. I mean, that's a really, really huge thing in terms of a teacher making the move to charge you. Not was it? Did it feel like he wanted to? He needed the money, or was it? It's something happened to him to kind of like he wanted to go down that route. Whereas before, he might have enjoyed the talks and engaging people, but it wasn't. He wasn't charging, and it sort of seemed like a kind of a different scene.
Very different scene, and I can't tell you why he charged or not. I mean, certainly he didn't, as they say, need the money, because his books were making so much, but there, maybe he wanted more, or maybe he felt people learn more effectively if he charged. Who knows what that, I don't know about that, but I do know, I mean, what he said about why he went big. This is what he said. He said, I'm going to die, and I'm getting old, and, he died of cancer, although his followers deny that. He did die of cancer, and he knew he had cancer long, long before he told the people around him, and he was always ill with one thing and another, and so I don't know when exactly he was diagnosed. It was liver cancer, so he could have it for a while. And but he said, I'm going to die in the 90s. I know I'm getting older, and I want to spread the word, as it were, because once I'm gone, There may or may not be another one to follow me, and I have to spread it to as many people as possible.
Yeah. That's funny. It's
You mentioned Bruce Wagner. He made those videotapes. You knew someone who knew Bruce?
Yeah.
And you knew about these groups?
Yeah. Because I remember feeling like at the time, like, ooh, this is it. This is like the magic. I could go. And like, you know, I was in New York at the time.
Were you invited?
And I was like, I could feel the vibe. And my friend, who I won't mention because I don't know if he'd want to be mentioned in this way, but he was also very much like on the edge of it, but could feel the magic. And he was sort of a magic maker himself, where he would kind of, anything he'd tell me about, like a book or anything, was always had this air of secrecy. And it's amazing to think about,
invited,
like, the way
Eric?
That these things make, you know, they stir our desire for a teacher, our desire for to find the answer, our desire to dodge death. I mean, that becomes like the big
thing. Could you get into the class if you wanted?
Excuse me?
Were you invited into the class? You could have worked your way,
yes,
I guess what you're saying.
That's what I would say.
And I'm sure you could have, if you'd chosen to leave New York and hang around the right people and that kind of thing. And people did.
But I was already too skeptical.
Huh? You would never have made it. You would have been spotted and kicked out instantly. If you were skeptical, if you dared to open your mouth. There was a very short period when you first were taken into the group, especially if you were a woman and you were going to be one of the mistresses, because it was a harem. And I didn't know that for years. I thought we were engaged and going to get married. And because I lived in Berkeley and would come down and see Carlos and stay at a little hotel or something near him, it was years before I figured out I was in a real harem. And by then I was already sold. But then there's this little matter of jealousy, which Carlos worked and played to the maximum. That's all in my book in scandalous detail. It was a nasty environment. And then, of course, the men, Carlos was not bisexual, and the men were not supposed to have, the women weren't supposed to have sex with anyone but Carlos, ever, and that, for the rest of your life. And then the men weren't supposed to have sex ever, except once in a while, maybe three times or something. They would have some of them would have sex with the witches, who were three women who were the closest to Carlos. They were among the people who committed suicide. And Florinda Donner, you may have heard of her. She wrote three books. They're very good. Very good writer about her experiences in the sorcerer's world. So there you were, not supposed to have sex, and if you're a man, ever again, that's something to sign up for, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, could you talk a little bit about the witches? They are some intriguing characters. Like when you first kind of got into the scene, like what was the story about them and their powers?
Well, the first time I met Carlos, my father, you know, I met the most amazing people because I was the daughter of a celebrity and I was pretty fearless, and the only time I'd ever been impressed, like deeply and profoundly and truly impressed, was when my father met John Lennon, and John Lennon was a fan of my father's, and Yoko pulled him over and said, "It's Irving Wallace. John, come, you can shake his hand." And I was like, "What? John Lennon wants to shake Dad's hand?" You know, I love my dad, but I still, my hero is, and that story was John Lennon. And but this was the second time I was fearsomely impressed, and my father said, "I met Carlos Castaneda," and I was like, "You can't just meet Carlos Castaneda. What are you talking about?" And he said, "His agent is our old family friend, and we had a dinner, and Carlos was there with a woman, and I don't know what their relationship was. It was kind of funny. I couldn't tell." He said, "Anyway, I want you to meet him." And for the only time in my life, I said to my dad, "No." Of this something of this kind, and he said, "What do you mean, no?" And I said, "You can't. I'm too scared. He's too famous. It's too much." And he said, "Well, I insist." And I said, "Oh, okay." And the minute I met, we had another such dinner set up with the same people, and he brought one of these women, And it was true. It wasn't like quite a normal date. Something, there was something odd about their relationship. It wasn't quite friends. Wasn't quite date. But anyway, there he was, and they were both so charming and so warm and so affectionate. And I completely forgot to be nervous in a minute. And Carlos is one of the greatest storytellers I've ever met. And my father was another, and the two of them together were great. They liked each other a lot. And so it was great fun, and Carlos told wonderful stories. And then he and this woman, Taisha, took me, well, she was going by another name. Everybody in the group had like 10 names, you know, and I had another name and et cetera. But they took me by the hands and they just said, oh, you're going to, I was going to boarding school at that time. And they're just like, oh, stay in touch with us. We'll be in touch with you. We'll see you again. And it had this very kind of moving feeling to it. And then I had one of those dreams, and I'm not big on supernatural dreams, but I had a dream that I was with three women and a man. I didn't know there were three witches at the time, and they talked about how we were going to make a revolution. Well, that was my language as a little 60s, 70s person, you know, who's political. But actually, Carlos used to talk about the revolution of the self, making a spiritual revolution. That was his language. So I had this interesting dream right away afterwards. Thought, never forgot it. And then Carlos started, would call up and call my dad and say, where's Amy? And, because I lived in Berkeley, I'd either be in town visiting, working on, I wrote books with my family, and I would be in town working on books, or I would be up in Berkeley working on my own books. And if I was there, Carlos would say, I'll come over. And he'd come over and we'd go out to dinner or something. And if I wasn't there, I'd get a phone number, and the phone number would not be good anymore, like an hour later, you know, or by the time I got it. But he often had these women with him. And the one I was closest to was the one I just mentioned, who wrote the books, Florinda Donner. One of the other ones wrote books too, but her books were very powerful. And she and I really hit it off. And that's really how I came to be in the group. As I was living in Berkeley, and she was speaking at a spiritual center about three blocks from my house. And I wasn't feeling well. And I read about it, and I thought, oh, I wonder how she is. I haven't seen her in a decade or so. And I thought, I'll take an aspirin and just go. And I went, and she was there with a third woman, who I found out was the third of these women, but who hasn't written a book, the one who did not commit suicide, and lives in L.A. And they both came up to me and said, oh, Carlos is going to be so happy that we found you. Interesting language. We found you. We found you. Now we've got you back again. As if I was this long lost jewel, you know. And I had just published my first novel, and I gave it to them, and they really loved it, and they were really, and they got back, called me, and then Carlos, Florinda called me and said, he's going to call, and so wait for his call. And he called, and it was lovely, and I quickly got the idea, not fast enough, but that when he spoke, you didn't have a conversation, you listened. And soon enough I said, I'm going to be back in L.A. in a short while. And he said, we've got to see you. We have these classes where we do movements I learned from Don Juan, and I've got to see you. And one thing led to another, and next thing we're at a motel. it took a little while, but there were the classes, and then I thought I was his only lover at these motels, and it was slowly brought to my attention that I was to be part of this group. I would have to, you know, conquer jealousy, because that was just ego and concern about the self. et cetera.
Yeah, classic stuff. So listen, there's so much more to talk about here, but we got to take a break here, and we'll be right back after a few messages. I'm Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind. I'm talking with Amy Wallace, and we'll be right back.
Listening to the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, Progressive Radio Network.
Mike Fader here. Every Thursday following Gary Null from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, I will expound and expand on stories, both personal and public, attempting to make the sometimes ephemeral but always essential connections between our internal landscapes and our external lives. So please join me, Mike Fader, Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time for The Turning Point, here on the Progressive Radio Network.
Is someone driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
I'm so excited to be on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be able to talk to you live, answer your questions, and work with you for your own patient rights. Tune in every Sunday at 5 p.m. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you on Sunday, 5 p.m.
The most news anywhere on the internet. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, your number one source for everything progressive.
This is John Mapplethorpe. Every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, I'll be revealing secrets, deceptions, and hoaxes of the medical cartel. I've been covering this waterfront for 30 years as a reporter, and I know where the bodies are buried. With guests and commentary, I'll rip open the lid on vaccines, psychiatric drugs, the FDA, pharmaceutical companies, germ research, and media cover-ups. Don't check your brain at the door. Tune it up. Every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern on PRN, The John Rappaport Show.
The Progressive Radio Network, and you know what that means? It means you, my friend, are an informed individual, and we thank you.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Amy Wallace about Carlos Castaneda and her experience with it turned out to be a pretty unpleasant situation. I do want to ask though, just when you were getting involved in the group, to talk a little, to let people know a little bit about what was the sort of what were the mysteries that were being revealed? What were the promises about the secrets of the Sorcerer's Path? Was there, were you going to, you know, live forever or get secret powers? Or what was the kind of feeling that people had about what they were discovering?
You bet. The idea was that we were all going to flame on, as they said in the Fantastic Four, wasn't it? Burst into flame together in and move from this level as a group, and move from this level of awareness to a higher level of awareness where we would travel in infinity together. It was changed from day to day that whether we take our bodies or not. Sometimes he'd say, I'm taking my shoes. When I catch fire, everything's going to come with me. I wasn't quite clear how it would reconstruct. And other times we would just drift off into another world, and we'd always be together, and we would endless mysteries would be discovered. If we didn't toe the sorcerer's line, and there were lots of things we had to do and not do, lots of rules. The main rule was to do everything Carlos said, no matter how much it contradicted the thing he told you the day before. Then we would wind up the victim of these beings that prowl the earth, which he called the flyers, which supposedly eat our consciousness, literally. And he said our consciousness is like an aura, egg-shaped aura, our awareness that grows up from our toes and covers our the top of our heads in the shape of an egg. But most of us don't have any awareness left because we think about ourselves, I, me, me, me. And the flyers feed on these thoughts, and they all we have left is a little awareness left around our toes. But there's a certain meditation he taught, which I write about in Sorcerer's Apprentice, called the recapitulation. And if you do that enough, and a few other exercises that I wrote about in the book, then supposedly you can grow back your sheen of awareness, and then you can fly on, even though he's not here. He did offer, by the way, his teacherhood to somebody else. There's an amazing guy in Mexico who he wanted to have be his heir, and he runs a Buddhist institute called Casa Tibet, and his name is Tony Karam, and he's a wonderful man, and he declined because he'd seen too much corruption. And he respected the best of Carlos, and always has, and said he'll always love the things about him that there were to love, but that he couldn't possibly get involved in anything that corrupt.
Yes, that's impressive at that kind of level. You know, it's funny how addictive or attractive power can be, and especially when you get into this realm where there's like a blurring of like fiction and fabulation and lie and dream and desire, and it's just a very, very intoxicating brew. And I guess part of the point I was saying before was it seems like it's a great thing to write books out of.
Oh, it
but
is.
But it's a terrible thing to create, you know, controlling organizations out of.
Look at it this way. If you can get chicks, pardon my language, by joining a rock and roll band, and I know because I was married to a musician, then think what you can do as a guru who has the secrets of the universe. I mean, there's women, there's money, there's power. It's very lonely at the top, though, because everybody fawns over you, and that sounds great, and to some personalities it's addictive, but it's very creepy not to be able to ever take the mask off, I would think.
Yeah, it sounds hellish, actually. I mean, did you get a sense of that side of him?
He told me that anyone who had sex, because I'd had sex with him, and he'd implanted his magic seed, which was anti-flyer. Remember the flyers we were just talking about, the evil beings? This was like poison against them. And it would imbue me with magic powers and an ability to travel to these other dimensions more easily and more swiftly. That anyone who ever had sex with me again would have a connection to that. So, it was a kind of a... what do you call it? What's that Flyers mileage program? Mileage Plus, I used to call it. So I got a sense that I did not take up what Carlos said, and of course I have affairs. I have a boyfriend now, and but early days I was involved with people who were in the group, been sort of outside of the group, and when I told them that, I could see them kind of flicker with the, some of them with the, wow, am I getting a piece of this? Pardon the pun. But really, these are people who had become so indoctrinated that, and sex magic is as old as the hills. isn't it? I mean, we go back to Aleister Crowley and Gurdjieff, and
a lot older, a lot farther back than that. So yeah,
yeah,
it is
exactly. So, so now I possessed sex magic, and besides, I'd been told all these stories, and I'd been told more stories than I could. I mean, I crammed as many stories into Sorcerer's Apprentice as I possibly could, but I've been told so many. Many more, and these are people were hungry for every word, every story, and the, some of the witches were of great interest to people, and people wanted to hear all about them. And you know, you can only put so, even in a good long book, you can only put so much. So yeah, so I got a taste of what it's like. I also got a taste of it when I was in the group. Even though I was the scapegoat in the group, I would occasionally be. I would be picked up and then tossed out, and picked up and tossed out. And arguably had the most bouncy, I don't say that in a happy way, the most up and down career in and out of that group, of anyone. Because I have a big mouth and I'm cynical too, and I just wouldn't be a good little sorcerer. I would question things and I'd get in terrible trouble, and then I'd want to do everything to get back in, and I would. And,
so how did it work with you in terms of like how much you were believing like the most out, like the stuff about the flyers and the going together to another plane?
Well,
did it sort of fluctuate for you, or was there a certain point where it all just kind of broke down really drastically?
Yes, the latter. What happened was that I was in the group, let's say, for 8 years, and in the first years I just believed everything. And then slowly, I stopped believing. Like he would have diet plans for each one of us. Like he would monitor what we ate today. And I started to drift on that. I was like, this is silly. You know, he has some really dumb ideas about diet, and like you should cook your vegetables till they're mush, or you know, and things like that. And I would just started eating a lot more normally, and or just like eating outside of the program, and little things like that. But he was monitoring everything. He monitored our clothes, and he thought I dressed too much like a hippie, and I got my feelings really badly hurt, and I decided I would be the best dressed, and I started dressing very chic clothes, and then all the women were, then I was admired for that, and the women were jealous, and then I was considered to be overdressed, and then I had to hippie down again, and so everything was monitored. So at one point, like you said, at a certain point toward the end, though, I to be honest, it took me a long time, I began to see lies forming in front of, I began to be so close to some of the women that I saw them get drunk, and when they got drunk, they'd talk, and I began to see the fabrications being invented and being made in front of my eyes, and at that point things started to just melt down for me.
Well, what's that like to go through not just the social group that you are so deeply bound up with and that you're relying on for so much of your social meaning, but also your whole like worldview, like all starts to unravel like that. Like, how did you get through that?
Stress syndrome is what happens. I mean, you really do. I really still have to a certain extent. Some PTSD. Like I still go, if I go back in the neighborhood that we were in, I feel like I moved to a totally different part of Los Angeles where I won't run into any of these people. But when I go back into that old neighborhood, I feel really ill and shaky, and certain things set me off. I mean, I went to the movies with Florinda almost literally every day. Or every other day, and the other witches for years. I mean, because I'm a writer and I can make my own time schedule for my work, and I worked, and Carlos had an office too, and I worked there, and I was the only person who didn't get paid, which was charming. And but anyway, I was available to go to the movies, and sorry, what was the question you asked? What's it like to have your worldview?
Well, yeah, I was just kind of curious about how you went through the process of, like, of, you know, sudden, you know, radically disenchanting yourself.
Oh, well, I mean, I became like a sort of more of a pal by going every day to the movies and then a meal and then going out and having sake, and I became something more of a pal than some of the other people were, and that, I mean, never totally, but a lot more, and that allowed me to get a view inside, and things did start to fall apart. And I brought up the movies because I can go to the movies now, but for the first couple of years, I couldn't even go to a movie. And my boyfriend is a great film lover, and he could attest that I was, you know, I just couldn't stand to go to the movie theater. It was too upsetting. It reminded me of the people that were dead that I went to the movies with. But, I mean, fortunately, that's past. But, no, it was disastrous. And, I mean, I'll tell a spicy story. I'll tell it tastefully, but as things were falling apart, Carlos had died. A lot of the people in the group believed that he'd gone to another plane and had not really died. A lot of the people knew that he'd actually died and been cremated, and, you know. There was a party. It was an attempt to sort of cheer up and have a party, and at that time I had a house. It had room for a party. And it had a rooftop and with, you know, patio furniture. And everybody got really drunk. And I purposely decided not to have anything to drink because I just wanted to keep my eyes open and see what would happen to all these people. And because a lot of them hadn't, some of them drank a lot and some of them and took drugs, and others hadn't had a drink in 10 years because Carlos had told them not to. And others drank behind his back. So there were two ways. So a lot of people got really toasted. And up on the rooftop, a little mini orgy developed. And it was mostly girls. The girls were the girls. And the one particularly sweet and naive and believe everything guy walked up the stairs and walked into this and saw this and freaked out because he thought no one had had sex with anybody all this time. He didn't know anything about it. And all of a sudden, not only were they having sex, they were having kind of a lot of it with another gender, and it was just all, you know, mind-bending. And afterwards, he was like, what are we going to do? What are we going to tell him? I gave him another name in my book. I called him Buddy in Sorcerer's Apprentice. And I said, what are we going to do about Buddy? And I said, oh, for God's sake, I'll take care of it. And I said, because they were making up these crazy stories, like the green beings, because Carlos used to say, you have a green aura, and you have an amber aura, and you have a yellow aura, and you have a peach aura. And stories were being made up that I could see people believing them as they made them up. The green beings were merging with the amber beings. I kid you not, Eric. And I thought, this is such nonsense. And I called up Buddy and I said, Buddy, everybody got drunk and went crazy, okay? Sorry you had to see it like that. And then everybody, the people who weren't up there doing that were dancing downstairs, and one couple was drunk enough that they crashed through a plate glass window, and it wasn't safety glass, so it's a God blessing that nobody got hurt. And there were two people who were doctors there, and, you know, bound up their small wounds, and the glass had to be, you know, replaced the next day and boarded up. It was the whole kind of front yard was open, and they're like, what are we going to tell Carol, because Carol was the witch who didn't, I used her real name in the book, go commit suicide. And how are we going to tell her? She'd already left the party. What are we going to say? What are we going to tell her? I said, we're going to tell her what happened is what we're going to do. And I said, I'll take care of it. And I called her up and I said, everybody got really drunk and fell through the window. And she went, oh, God, that's what happens when you don't drink for years. And typical. And she just rolled her groaned, you know, and I went, yeah, well, they're putting in a new one today. See, it's like, that's what it was like to be a little closer to them. You could just be a little more realistic. But on the other hand, they'd also, suddenly they'd flip and switch. You couldn't be realistic. You could sometimes be realistic. I'm trying to give you an idea of how Alice in Wonderlandy this was. The next day it would be, well, you know, you killed Carlos, Amy. That, I wasn't going by the name Amy anymore then. I was, they'd given me my sorcery name, which was beautiful, which was Ellis, a very pretty name. And they were like, Ellis, you killed Carlos because you had sex with him. The first time you had sex with him, he'd asked me if I was taking any medication, and I had migraines, and I used to take narcotics and muscle relaxants, and I said, so I've taken those, and I also take Prozac. Well, he didn't care anything about narcotics or muscle relaxants at all, but he was incredibly upset about the Prozac. He went berserk, and I was kicked out of the group, and of course I flushed it all down the toilet. Not the way you should come off an antidepressant. and then I became suicidal. That was great.
You know, we only have a few minutes left. I wanted to get a sort of general comment on you. Do you feel that has this really changed your whole idea about the whole spiritual search, the idea that there's some, you know, that there are methods, that there are esoteric schools, that there is something worthwhile for this? Or has it left you with a more bitter sense about how human beings actually are, and that if you think you're going to go this way, you're probably fooling yourself?
I had some physical illnesses, and out of curiosity, I'll say this really fast, I went twice to Brazil to see a psychic surgeon, and it didn't happen to didn't happen to work for me, but I saw him inches from me stick his hands in people and take out tumors and, you know, and sew them up. And so I saw the impossible hundreds of times. And I needed to go see that, even if it didn't happen to me, just so that I could see that it existed. So, yes, there's still magic. It just didn't happen that Carlos was magic in the way that he said he was. A magical writer and a magical talker and a charismatic being, and I loved him at the time, but and there'll be always love something of him, though I feel basically rather bitter about his scene. But I believe there's magic in the world, yes. And there are no doubt elders and who are pure of heart. I do believe that.
Did he ever give the sense that, or kind of admit in any way that Don Juan was not entirely real, or was it always 100% Don Juan was just a human being that he had met and passed on?
He wavered. He wavered. That's a big subject. Mostly he was straight down the line, Don Juan this, Don Juan that, and sometimes he wavered. That's the only way I can encapsulate it.
No, that makes sense. Are you in touch with anybody from the group or people who have already left, or is
God,
it just like a closed book?
Oh God, they hate me so much. Since I wrote *Torture's Apprentice*, they hate me. Although it's very truthful, I mean, it is absolutely just the story as I experienced it. No embellishment or flourishing. It is true. And but you know, I'm friends with I have a couple of friends who are on the outer fringes, not the inner group. People who maybe would have liked to be in the inner group but weren't obsessed with it, people who had their own lives and kept them, and I have a couple of those friends. And but you know, there's a called Sorcerer's Publicity. I have a email site for, you know, people to write who've read the book or, you know, or want to talk to me. And I said to my boyfriend, would you just take this over? Because I don't want to read. I've been reading these emails for years and been involved with these sites, and I'm blown out. And I said, and don't tell me when people want to kill me, okay? Just tell me the good stuff. Send me those. And so after about 5 years, I was like, okay, so how many people wanted to kill me? And he said, oh, there were a few. We know where you live. We're going to come get you. And he said, that's slowing down. And, you know,
I'm glad he's around to help you, you know, see the light side of the whole thing. I mean, you sound very good now. You sound like you've come through this pretty hair-raising experience.
I hope this wasn't too dark for your show.
No, it's what I mean. It's really important stuff. I mean, I remember when I saw this, there was I think it was a BBC documentary that was using a lot of the material from your book and telling a pretty brutal story. And it was a shock for me because I had – even though I knew he was a trickster and the books were kind of tricky and that I couldn't quite believe it and that, you know, that whole scene in the 90s always seemed kind of weird and a little creepy to me, I still had a lot of, you know, kind of unquestioned faith in the goodness of the overall project. And I was really shocked at seeing how much of it's like the typical Holt,
the womanizing and the, but
thing,
you know, you made an interesting choice because you decided not to pick up your life in New York and come out here and do everything to get in. I mean, you made a good call.
Yeah, as I said, I've been skeptical for just so long. I'm a skeptical seeker, you know.
Good, that's a good thing to be, and so am I, and I always will be. And no, I'm not. I don't believe magic is there's no magic in the world. Of course, I do believe there is, and believe me, it's amazing to see psychic surgery. That's something to see some other time to talk
about.
All
right,
that.
Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Expanding minds.
Okay, bye.
All right, folks, from Eric Davis, thank you so much for listening, and keep your minds open.